You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. There ain't no such thing as a free sample. The minefield of martial arts competition. When a student comes to me and says, "I'd like to compete," it both excites me for them and makes me nervous. A student's first competition experience can, for good or ill, influence their future martial arts behavior far more than perhaps it should. Students who fare well in their first competitive outing, especially very well, can become more difficult to coach in the future. Their success will naturally breed more confidence in their own ideas than they had before. If their teacher is not a very good one, this is actually a positive thing. But if he or she is a quality instructor, this can lead to unnecessary friction. An experienced coach can lay the groundwork for dealing with this problem by warning students in advance about it when he or she first perceives that a new student is a special talent. Students who fare badly in their first competition can also read too much into the results. They may experience thoughts like, "What good is my training if I lost?" It can be good to remind the student at this point that his opponent was trained as well. Remember, you can do everything right and still lose. It's also important to remember that it's better to feel good about your performance and lose than to feel bad about your performance and win. Another potential problem is when the student allows his or her competitive juices to get out of control, leading to shameful behavior and bad sportsmanship. This kind of behavior can stem from thinking of your opponent as the enemy. Losing to the enemy is far worse than losing to a worthy opponent. Do not hate your opponent. You probably have far more in common with him or her than anyone else in the building. It's also important to remember that it's not necessary to compete to be fully realized as a martial artist. I run an academy in which there are actively competing martial sport athletes and non-sport athletes. I want all of them to understand that they are all on the same team. Competitive martial arts is a team sport, even if it is an individual who is expressing it at any given moment. You hone your tools on your training partners. Many of them may not be competitors themselves, but they too contribute in a significant way to whatever success you may achieve. Now, there are academies where those students who compete regularly, and especially those who win regularly, are given preferential treatment over the other students. But a good instructor should remember that all students are of equal importance. Each one is fighting his own battle in his own way, and each one is contributing to keeping your gym open. A fascinating aspect of competition is the individual who dominates in practice at the gym, but consistently loses in competition. On the other hand, I also occasionally see a student who hasn't shown me much in practice, but turns out to do extremely well under the pressure of competition. I learned a long time ago to make no assumptions about how a student would do in competition based only on how they do in training. I've been fooled too many times. What exactly do we learn from a martial arts competition? One reason that many people come away from competition with an assessment of their level that is either too low or too high is that we are humans with human brains. Humans who aren't educated in the field of statistics, in other words, the vast majority of us, tend to do a terrible job of understanding how to gather, interpret, and analyze data. One of the most important aspects of data analysis is understanding the sample size. Let's see if I can explain sample size. Let's say there are 1,000 people gathered in an auditorium. You ask 2 of the 1,000 people to tell you their blood type. Now, assuming that you don't creep them out by asking and that they don't lie to you, you should get 2 reliable answers, or 2 data points. Let's say that by chance, one of the two people has the blood type AB negative. Only 0.6% of people have this blood type. Yet you can now say that, quote, 50% of those surveyed had AB negative blood, unquote. Right? While it's not technically wrong to make this statement, the statement is totally misleading. It carries pretty near zero usable information. Your sample size out of 1,000 people was 2. Tiny sample sizes lead to either no significant information, or worse, can lead to completely false conclusions. The larger your sample size, the more precise the conclusions you can draw from the data. If you expand the sample size to 100 people out of the 1,000 and still get one person with AB negative blood, the picture looks quite different and is pretty close to the right number. If you ask each of the 1,000 people, you will get a result that is maximally precise, but only for those 1,000 people. It would still be a tiny sample size compared to the total population of the Earth. In that case, 1,000 people would be about 1/7,000,000th of the Earth's people. That's a far smaller sample size than your first survey of 2 people out of 1,000. As a matter of fact, more than 10,000 times smaller. That tells us the other constraint when it comes to sample size. The larger the sample size, the more expensive it is to gather the data, whether in terms of money or time. If this weren't the case, then you should always go for the maximum sample size every time in order to draw the most precise conclusions. Let's apply this to martial arts competition. Let's say you compete in a single elimination tournament and lose your first match, which means you're done for the day. That is a sample size of 1. Let's say you compete in a tournament and there is only one other competitor in your division, and you win the match. This actually happens quite a bit. That, again, is a sample size of 1. A sample size of 1 is as close to meaningless as you can get. If the competition is divided into levels, like belt ranks, the data can become even more fuzzy, especially in the lower ranks. It's my experience that the lowest level of competition, often this is the white belt level, has the largest diversity of skill levels, from lowest to highest. There are several causes for this. One is that some instructors hold back promotion of students in order to have better competitors in the lower divisions. Another is that some individuals flat out lie about their rank, claiming a lower rank than they deserve in order to improve their chances of securing a trophy. And of course, there are those gifted individuals who are destined to move rapidly through the ranks, but who by sheer chance are going into their first competition on that day. Throw all these people into the white belt division with the average and below average white belts, and you get all kinds of bizarre matchups for the first match. I know of several examples of high-level judo or wrestling champions who entered jiu-jitsu competitions at the white belt level. Naturally, they did very well, and walked away with lots of medals. But what did the medals mean? What is the quality of the data from any martial arts competition? When I tell my students that if you compete infrequently, say once or twice a year, you're doing it more for the experience than the result. You are putting yourself in a stressful situation and trying to function. Compete hard and enjoy the thrill. Try not to get hurt and learn what lessons you can. And try not to read too much into winning or losing. To get a significant sample size from competition, you need to compete a lot, for a long time. If you do that, then after some time you will accumulate a significant amount of data and can read something significant into it. So, is competing worth the time, money, and effort? Sure, if you have your mind right and have a good time. After all, you get to meet people from other cities and towns who are just as obsessed with the martial arts as you are. There are many ways outside of the martial arts that ignorance of the importance of sample size can affect you. For example, now that you, I hope, better understand the importance of sample size when analyzing information, this should also clue you in to think twice when you hear news of a scientific study with results that sound sensationally bad or sensationally good. Before you react to the news, you should look into how rigorous the study was. And one of the most important aspects of rigor in analyzing data is, you guessed it, sample size. To make matters worse, most modern news reporters, and you'll probably hear about the study through the news, are scientifically and statistically illiterate and are consistently prone to overreacting to the results of studies. Remember that larger sample sizes push up the financial cost of a study. Because of this, it's usually the case that interesting results from a study with a small sample size tell you pretty much one thing and one thing only: that it might be worth the money to do a bigger study. And that's all you can meaningfully say about it. So when you hear a reporter make a statement like, "A new study suggests that belly button lint might be a cure for cancer," or, "A recent study shows that wearing yellow shoes might cause birth defects in your children," you should look into the details of the study yourself before drawing any conclusions. If you don't want to take the trouble to do that, then you should ignore what you hear. This sort of poor reporting is sometimes the fault of a poorly educated reporter, and sometimes the fault of a scientist who does a terrible job of communicating the results with the reporter. Remember, as I'm fond of pointing out, critical thinking skills are also self-defense skills. The more you understand about scientific rigor, the less likely you are to be taken in by the results of flawed studies and the predators who use them as a tool to con you. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.